You're listening to Motor Chat and we're sponsored by the Motorcycle Riders Association in partnership with the South Australian Government. Think road safety.
Is Motor Chat on 88.7 Adelaide's Coast FM.
And welcome to Motor Chat this Wednesday evening on
the 24th.
January.
Gosh,
wow, it's going through this year already, and it's our second show.
Do you realise that there's only another 11 months to Christmas?
Yeah.
Or Christmas Eve.
Don't tell me about it.
I can't afford it, so don't worry about it.
So welcome to Motor Chat again with Harold, Kathy and Ebi here in the studio, and we hope you enjoyed tonight's. We're talking about electric motorcycles because electric vehicles are a really big thing around the world, and we're just going to explore a few things about electric motorcycles with Dennis Savage of Savage Motorcycles from Melbourne. Welcome, Dennis.
Hey, good evening, everybody. How are you?
We're doing well.
Yeah, we're fine. Nice and cool here.
Actually, it's humid. He tells a lie. Yeah. The studio's cool. So what's the weather like in Melbourne at the moment?
I think it's pretty similar. I don't think it's quite as humid as Adelaide, but it's on the cooler side.
Yeah, because actually, unfortunately, at the moment, I think there's that a huge trough of humid weather coming in from the Kimberley regions right across Australia, going across Adelaide,
right.
Running into Melbourne and heavens knows where else.
Yeah, hasn't hit us yet, fortunately. So yeah.
Okay, enough of the weather, guys. We've already done that.
We have. We've done it to death.
Electric vehicles. Let's talk generally a bit. Are they really going to be the future when you consider all the problems, and which we'll talk about later on, or are they just a fad for our modern times, something that people are getting on the bandwagon about? I mean, they've always been a big thing in science fiction, but are we making it a science reality, or are we just sort of playing with it?
Oh, philosophical question. Do you want me to go first?
Yes. you're the one who's the expert. We just follow along behind in the wake.
Clearly, I'm very experienced at this radio stuff. So, look, I think they're definitely well and truly here. Definitely not. They were science fiction once upon a time, but the technology's gotten to a point where it's very commercially viable to have it, and definitely, you know, in countries outside of Australia, preferable. And I think they're definitely, the uptake in Australia is increasing quite significantly if you look at the purchasing statistics. You travel to countries like China and the US, and I mean, I don't know this, but I was looking at 50% of all vehicles on the road are electric already. So I think, you know, in terms of what's science fiction or, you know, further into the future, you're probably looking at hydrogen technology now, and electric vehicles are just a stepping stone.
Yeah. Look, I know that we've had statistics before saying that the electric vehicle industry in Australia has taken off so much that it's around about 300% on top of what the expectations were at the moment. So people have just gone silly stupid buying them. Is that a problem for your developing, the stuff that you're developing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, our objective, we produce high-performance electric motorcycles, right? And they're just, you know, some people will use them as a commute, and other people will use them as a luxury product. But at the end of the day, our ambition wasn't to produce an electric motorcycle per se. We just want to produce an awesome bike that just happens to be electric. So, we've got quite a decent size order book that's waiting for a bike to come out of the factory, and We ask our customers questions all the time about this kind of stuff, and the most common answer is we honestly just like the way it looked and the performance specifications and the fact that it's electric and they can charge at home is just a bonus.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if you can hear a screaming baby.
Because there is.
That's okay.
Look, we can scream here too if you like, just to make you feel more comfortable.
Dennis, I've just had a couple of text call pop up on my phone, and the first question that I have, and I think I'm might actually be running in on questions later on, but how much range do they actually have, and what sort of how long do they actually take to charge, or is there varying charging depending upon the charges you've got?
Yeah, it really depends on where you charge. So I'll start from the start. I mean, so the first product that we are commercialising and bringing to market is called the C Series. C stands for Cafe Racer, and that's a particular style of motorcycle. Yep. As you guys are probably well aware.
Yep.
And there's two variants or two models that we have of the C Series, and one's called an Alpha and one's the Delta. And the Alpha is our higher performance specification. It has a lot, more power, more range, and the Delta has slightly less power and less range, so there's two different price points. And the Alpha's $26,990 and the Delta's $9,990. So the reason I preface the charging question with that is because it really depends on how big your battery pack is. Our vehicles all have a capability to go up to 3.3 kilowatts of charging, and the standard wall plug at home is 1.8. So you can basically go to 3.3 if you've got three phase at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Alpha has a 16.2 kilowatt hour battery pack. So if you divide 16.2 by 3.3, you land somewhere in the order of 4 to 5 hours, from completely empty to fully charged. And then the Delta has a slightly smaller battery pack, so it's a little bit faster again.
Right, okay. So, okay, that means a hell of a lot to electricians and people working in that area. And I can sort of follow your logic, because we've had a solar system installed on the house.
Yep.
And I think we're talking relatively similar numbers, but certainly nowhere near the charge rate. So, obviously the commercial charge rate is much better, which is the big advantage. And is that also the disadvantage for, I suppose, the touring bike as such, in that the charge rate that's available as you go along is relatively low, or is that just a misconception?
No, I think it's definitely a concern for touring riders. Now, the technology to charge very quickly is there in the form of DC fast charging, and, if we had that capability on our products, you'd get to 80% charge within 20, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so that's not really an issue. The issue is, if you're a touring rider, is the infrastructure in Australia, especially, in riding areas, you're talking about relatively remote or hilly areas, they're not necessarily, there might not be a business case to install a charging network there. Where things might start to move more into longer rides on an electric bike is when you have a destination like a cafe up in the hills somewhere, or a restaurant you like to go to as a halfway point. If they installed a few chargers, in their parking lot, and the electric bikes could charge while they sat and had lunch, and then they could get home after that. That works really well. But in terms of going for, cross country and things like that, the infrastructure's not quite there yet, and that's why we haven't gone down the tour route. We don't think it's quite there yet.
Yeah. Actually, to be quite honest with you, if the Melbourne riders are similar to the Adelaide riders, and you install charging points at any cafe or stuff like that, you've got plenty of time. These guys never leave the cafe.
Dennis, we had Ed DeMarnon on air about 14, 15 months ago. He transported his bike over to Perth, and he wanted to ride from Perth to Sydney. He had a live wire, and it took him, I think it was 3 weeks to get across. Some days he was able to do 200 kilometres, depending on whether it was downhill or what.
Or whether he had a tailwind.
Or whether he had a tailwind.
Yeah.
But by and large, he said that it was very difficult across the Nullarbor because every place he stopped, he'd only get 200 kilometres a day, maybe 250. But some places would allow him to charge one of them even inside them, the hotel unit that he was in. So it was an interesting venture for him, but he was saying up and down the eastern seaboard there are heaps and heaps of charging points.
Correct.
And he goes up and down from Cairns all the way down to Melbourne.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely improving, but it will take time. You know, again, it comes down to a business case if you want to invest in a charging network and how many electric bikes are crossing or wanting to cross the Nullarbor at the moment. That's just one of those things.
I'd even be very wary about taking a petrol-powered bike across the Nullarbor, because especially some of the ones with the smaller tanks, for the simple reason that if you've got 180 k's between servos, and I think that's the last two distances, then you've got to throw a headwind into that, and all of a sudden your 250-kilometre range is very seriously compromised.
That's very true. Yeah,
I guess that in some ways, if electric motorcycles become more prevalent, then there's going to have to be a culture shift within the motorcycling community, in that we're used to just going to the survey, filling up, 5 minutes later we're on our way again. And if you go to the survey to fill up and you have to wait 30 minutes, you've got to have something else that you're going to do while you're waiting.
Have a cup of coffee.
Yeah. If you forecast out and look at green technology trends, I mean, we're currently, the most common chemistry at the moment is lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt for you know, more power orientated vehicles. Most cars use lithium iron phosphate, which is slightly less power dense but a bit more durable. And if you look at the trend, I mean, batteries are tending towards what's called a solid state battery. So the battery technology today has a liquid in it, effectively, and aside from the anodes and the cathodes. And that liquid is the thing that has historically resulted in, you know, potentially dangerous situations with batteries. And there are these now, I mean, of battery factories that we talk to frequently, and they're now developing semi-solid-state batteries as a midway point to solid-state. And with that technology, you're doubling your range just with that simple technology shift. And solid-state is also incredibly safe, even at... So, you know, I think the five-minute charge-up is definitely a possibility with technology improvements, but we're still... you know, probably 10 to 20 years away from solid state being commercially available.
Actually, can I just come back to a comment you made earlier on, and you were talking about hydrogen being a fuel of the future as well. So is electric sort of, like you said, the stepping stone to hydrogen, or is that going to be two competing technologies?
I don't think they're competing. They're definitely complementary, because even in a hybrid powertrain, you do have a battery pack. So basically, it depends on the system, but normally the hydrogen generates electricity, which then goes into a battery and then gets transmitted to a motor. So that's one way of doing it. Now, I have to admit, I'm not a hydrogen technology or industry expert by any stretch of the imagination. I definitely think that they are complementary. I don't think they will really compete. But I think products that have slightly different systems in there will compete with each other. And I think that, you know, ultimately the market decides what it wants.
Yeah, true. I suppose exactly the same as VHS and Beta and back in the dim dark days.
Yeah. Blu-ray HD.
Yeah.
I was watching a program the other night, and just it brought up a topic that I thought was unexpected. And that was that in North America at the moment, there are a lot of there's in some areas where there are a lot of charging stations, there's a big uptake in electric vehicles. The problem is, in winter, the temperatures get down below freezing, and so the batteries don't hold their charge as long. They can lose up to 40% of the charge that they provide, and it can take up to four times as long to charge to 100% if it's going to get to 100%. And so that's a big problem over there now.
My comment to that is that anybody that goes out when it's below freezing deserves that.
Stay at home.
Exactly.
It's not a problem for Australia.
No.
But what about us who like travelling in the high country, hey?
Oh, yeah.
Canberra in the middle of winter is a little bit chilly.
This is Motor Chat on 88.7 Adelaide's Coast FM.
And welcome back to Motor Chat this Wednesday night, with Kathy Eby and Harold and Dennis Savick. And Dennis is talking to us about electric motorcycles, which are all the rage at the moment. So, Dennis, electricity and motorcycles, what are the major challenges in developing an electric motorcycle, and how's that different to developing electric cars and trucks?
Oh, good question. To be honest, I don't think it's too different to developing electric cars and trucks. I think that the vehicle development process is largely consistent across industries. It's just that the user requirements are quite different. I think the hardest thing, where do I start? That's a pretty long list, and I don't know if we have enough time on the show to go through everything. But I think, at the end of the day, to build what we're building, I like to tell people that it's equally hard to engineer the product, but then also to establish a supply chain and make sure all the parts come in on time. And then on top of that, building a brand and a business out of all of that as well. I don't really want to say any of those are harder than the other. They're all very, very difficult in their own right.
Yeah, but really, what it comes down to is that the overall business model is, it's just taking a little bit of time, but certainly it's par for almost any sort of business that's especially new, challenging, with sort of, in a way, untried technology. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there aren't very many players in the in the high performance electric motorcycle category, and we're definitely one of a handful globally, and that's, I don't know, it's just very, very difficult to do. You're demanding relatively very high power with not a lot of real estate to play in, and where weight impacts you a lot more than it would in a four-wheeled vehicle.
As you're talking about with the extra power, what's the difference between the bike power between that and the combustion engine?
So I think that the biggest difference is the torque curve. So when you open up your throttle on a combustion engine motorcycle, your torque starts from zero, and then it takes a bit of time, and then when you hit the power band, or you generally experience a peak torque moment. And that's where the engine operates most efficiently. The big difference is with an electric vehicle, as soon as you twist the throttle, you have instantaneous torque and control over the torque. And the ability to ramp up torque and not need to slow down to clutch in and change gears, even if you have a quick shifter modification on your combustion bike, it's just totally different. In terms of a rider experience and the smoothness and the, don't get me wrong, a lot of people hear me and see me and just assume I detest combustion engines. It's, couldn't be further from the truth. I love a V8 as much as the next person, and at the moment I've got a Ducati Diavel in the garage, and I love riding that around. I definitely have an appreciation, but it's, it's the fact that, you know, having ridden our bikes and experienced it firsthand, and then jumping between combustion and electric, it's just, it's so, so different.
So you were talking about the difference between the torque and the throttle speed, sort of from turning it on. What about the handling of the motorcycle? Because there's a different weight ratio on that. What's the handling like, when, particularly when you're racing?
So racing's a different beast on its own, and we haven't developed a vehicle specifically for the track. To actually design and engineer and build and test and produce a race grade electric motorcycle is much more expensive than what we've done. Mm. What we've done is basically started with a business model, worked out what we need to sell it for, what we need to make it for, and understood if that's possible or not. We understood it was quite difficult, but we did it anyways. But when it comes to racing and on a racetrack, it's a very different powertrain. You have a very different battery pack, a very different motor, because the power requirements are very different. Having said that, when it comes to handling, and honestly, this is one of the things I'm most proud of on our bike, it's got very, very little to do with the actual powertrain technology. So handling really comes down to your structural geometry, as well as your center of gravity location and your suspension setup and things like that.
Yeah.
We've worked with a very lovely gentleman called Jed Metcher, who you know, raced at the ASBK, and we actually couldn't get a suspension supplier. If you think of a well-known suspension supplier, we've tried all of them, and none of them really wanted to support us because our volumes in terms of ordering from them weren't high enough. And so we said, stuff it, we'll just develop our own. And so we did that, and it gave us the freedom to really customize our suspension to suit our bike. And the feedback we've had from multiple very, very, you know, experienced professional riders is that it honestly handles beautifully and turns on a dime, even though our bike's weight is 280 kilos. It's deceptively heavy. It doesn't look as heavy. Well, it depends on who you ask, that's subjective, but it handles phenomenally, and that's a huge, huge kudos to a couple of really smart engineers on the team and a couple of really great, you know, professional racing riders.
That's good. That's what they call necessity is the mother of invention. To have achieved that is an amazing thing to do.
Well, certainly other people have grappled with that problem as well. I've been watching the Dakar, and there are a couple of electric motorcycles in that, and they're competitive.
Yeah.
They are competitive, and they handle the sand dunes just as well as any other bike. The only thing that the riders have mentioned is that you ride the bike differently because you don't have the gears.
Yes, yeah. It's just a different experience. I like the... if you think of a traditional bike, combustion engine bike, three out of four limbs are basically working all the time. I don't know about you guys, but I don't really use the rear brake all that often. But in an electric bike, it's the opposite. Three out of four limbs are resting all the time because you only really use front brake and your throttle, and there's no gears. So, I'm quite a vanilla rider. My favourite ride is to go out by myself and go up and down the coast, and it's kind of meditative in a way. And it's just that much more meditative on an electric bike. It's just, really enjoyable. You can hear the wind go by, you can hear the brakes. It's really phenomenal.
Yeah, so which way, east or west from Melbourne? Because we know both equally as well. And love both equally as well.
It depends on which way the wind's blowing.
So, of course, Dennis, it's fair to say that, again, there is, because it's electric, there is little or no motor noise, is there?
You'd be surprised. We do have, every bike has a slight rattle from the brakes. You can hear the road noise. We do run a belt on our bike and no chain. And so even though the belt's a lot quieter, it does produce noise. And then there is also a whir from the motor too. So it kind of sounds like, I don't know, it sounds quite futuristic.
It's a bit like Star Trek. Con-like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
A bit like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. We have tested at low speed a lot over the years, and we quite like the sound. We think it's super cool. It still turns heads, which is interesting. You wouldn't think it would. But when we did our top speed testing at Phillip Island, that was just a whole different. I got goosebumps just thinking about it. The thing sounded like a jet, because with a petrol bike, it's so, you know, especially on a racetrack and in a race setup, it's so loud you can't really hear much else but the engine. But because the electric bike, yes, it's got a whir, you actually hear all of the air being displaced around it.
Wow.
Anywhere from 150 k's an hour upwards. We clocked just shy of 170, and our alpha will do 190. But you could hear, it honestly sounded like a jet, and we've got the video evidence to back up that statement. It was, all of our jaws dropped. It was the best experience we've ever had.
Is that, have you got that video up on your website?
It's on our socials, it's on our Instagram. We can send you guys a link to that if you like.
Actually, if you could, please, at some stage, because, yeah, we'd love to people just to be able to experience what you're talking about, so we can certainly publicise that at on a future one as well, because it'd be great.
It would, and it'd be a very different sound to Spokey Dokes on the
on the bass drum.
it's so different. And that was, you know, the second part of how great that day was the fact that we basically had to pry the riders off the bike. They love off the bikes. They love them so much. They were like, this is so cool. I mean, they were shredding the tyres. They were having such a good time. Yeah. So it's a really, really good outcome.
They would have had to have gotten off once the battery had died, I guess.
Is that a possibility?
The batteries survive. They kept running laps, and the batteries held up really well. So on that testing day, we had two tests. We were running top speed and a thermal test. So in order to understand how the bike does thermally, meaning trying to understand how much heat it produces in what areas of the bike, and we want to verify our cooling system works. We said, yeah, just once we've done the top speed test, go hard on the track for as long as you can, and we ran out of time. The batteries held up really, really well.
Oh, fantastic. And of course, Motor Chat is sponsored by the Motorcycle Riders Association in partnership with the South Australian Government. Think road safety.
And isn't it great that all of a sudden now we've got all these motorcycle events coming up?
Oh, it's absolutely
been really bare for a couple of months.
It always is towards the end of the year.
So you reckon it might be a bull market at the moment?
Oh, no, it's just great.
No
bull about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. We just have difficulties trying to choose which ones we can get to, because sometimes they do coincide with each other.
While we've actually been doing Rider Roundup, I've had a couple of other texts come in, so I've got a few more questions to ask that are not on the list.
Okay. Well, it's Moto Chat, as everybody knows, and we're talking to Dennis Savage about electric motorcycles. And Dennis, one of the things that I noticed watching the Dakar is that some of the cars and some of the trucks have a mechanism whereby they actually regenerate some of the power that they're putting out, particularly if they're going downhill and that. Is that something you can actually do on a bike?
I don't see why you couldn't do it.
I'm just thinking about the volume that you've got and the weight that this mechanism would generate that you would have to carry around. And with a bike, we're always very conscious of how little space we've got.
So what you mean, like a magneto or an alternator type thing?
Well, basically, to generate electricity, you quite simply need a coil of copper wire and some permanent magnets in a particular arrangement. So you would just have to do some kind of analysis on what kind of suspension travel you normally experience at in whatever setting you're going to do it in, whether it be Dakar or on the road, and and then you look at the cost and the weight. They're your two main factors, and if you can justify them, I don't think there's anything available off the shelf that you could just bolt on, so it's probably a bit of a development program. But, you definitely could. The question is how effective it would be.
Dennis, I'm going to be totally and utterly irreverent here. I've got a picture in my mind. Remember the little spinning propellers that people used to have as bow ties? One of those on your gear as you drive riding along, I reckon that would do the trick.
I'm thinking about the hamster. Hamster on a wheel.
I do apologise to any purists, but I just had that vision in my head.
Oh, goodness me, and I live with it.
I'll put it to the design team.
I want rights for that one.
Maybe you just need a bigger hamster.
Yeah.
Go on, Eddie, ask your question.
Okay, the question that we that came in while we were going along is, and I've just been called an idiot, by the way, on the phone as well. The question is, how long have they actually been developing electric bikes for? Have you got any idea?
Yeah, so specifically or the industry?
Well, let's just say the industry, and then we'll become specific with yourself.
I think much like the history of cars, there definitely were electric motorcycles back in the early 1900s, for sure. Mm. Someone's put one together. I think that the reality is, we think we've got range anxiety. Well, battery technology 100 years ago was just a little bit worse, and so you had a very, very heavy motorbike. But I think I even saw one at Quigoma when they had... the Queensland Art Gallery of Modern Art put on an exhibition a year or two ago, I think a couple of years ago now, and I think they had a really old electric bike that was there from the 1940s. It really depends, but I think in terms of them becoming a little bit more mainstream, that probably started, especially in the scooter space, maybe about 6 years ago. And I mean, to have a product come out 6 years ago, you would have started development a couple of years before that. So, within the last decade, I'd say things have been commercialized, but I wouldn't be surprised if, the larger organizations like Yamaha and Honda and what have you had these in the works. And I think, LiveWire launched 2013. I think they had, I don't know if they started production back then, but they started producing media and advertising for it. So, your guess is as good as mine.
Right, okay. And, okay, so let's become specific. For how long have you guys been working on this?
So, I got the idea that I wanted to build an automotive business when I was 14. And I'm going to give
my that was only a few
there.
Years ago, wasn't it?
good one. Baby face, I don't feel as old as I look. So I turned 32 this year, so that was, 18 years ago, something like that. It's been a long time coming, and I basically got started as soon as I finished my engineering degree. Within a couple of weeks of finishing my last exam, I said, right, now I can get started, because I went to study engineering so I could do this. Mm. And I finished uni end of 14, so I started Jan 2015, sold my car and did the whole standard entrepreneur type stuff.
Mm. Oh, now, I'm going to admit now that you've told us how old you are, I was actually going to use the reference to the Auntie Jack show with Kid Eager using the propeller on himself. Well, thank goodness I didn't, because you wouldn't have known what I was talking about.
No, I certainly wouldn't have.
We're just a tad older than what you are. Oh, dear me.
Thank you for that. Okay. Okay, so, yep, I think yeah, Gary's actually quite happy with those answers, so it's good. Okay.
So when you're building an electric motorcycle, what's the, the comparison in price to building a combustion engine motorcycle?
I can't explicitly state, what it costs us to build our bikes. But I will say it is definitely a lot more expensive to build electric bikes. if you go back to kind of core materials, you know, most combustion engines are, you know, cast metals, you know, normally certain types of steel and what have you. And, you know, steel is industry-wide about $1 a kilo, and aluminium is about $5 a kilo, give or take, yeah, depending on fluctuations. And so if you look at the weight of a bike, you know, assume it's 200 kilos, and to be conservative, assume it's all aluminium, the more expensive material, you're looking at about $1,000 worth of material there. And then you've got all the manufacturing processes and so on. Now, our cells alone, you know, we manage to secure a pretty good price for ourselves, even though we are low volume, which is virtually unheard of in the industry. And, you know, the going rate for battery packs at the moment is anywhere from $150 to $250 per kilowatt hour. So it doesn't take a big calculation to work out, you know, in cells alone, before you've even done anything with them, you're at the price of the materials of a petrol bike or double. And so then you add on power electronics, which are not as cheap as casting metals. You know, it all adds up quite quickly. And thankfully, we have a phenomenal supply chain team, and we have a huge cost reduction effort and this year to get our costs down. And then so, you know, we will be at a point by the end of this year, you know, comparable to some of the larger manufacturers in terms of cost base. But when you compare that to a combustion engine, it's 2 to 3 times that of a
But then again, if you look at any product that's been developed over time, you know, our TVs, mobile phones, you name it, when they first came out, they were rudely expensive, and I think nobody could afford them. And now, with volume and you know, just general reductions, they're almost giving some of these things away. So, yeah, hopefully the motorcycle will go the same way.
Touch wood. We're hoping for it, that's for sure.
I think when you've got such a niche market, the boutique market of motorcycle manufacturing, I don't think you're going to get a huge reduction in the cost of manufacture, quite honestly.
Yeah, I think like there's definitely a valley of death. It's a really interesting economic phenomenon. I hope I'm not straying too much from the topic of the show. But the most successful brands out there either produce in low volume or, you know, with a high price tag, or they produce in very high volume with a low price tag. Mm-hmm. And if you try to do something in the middle, most brands that have tried that have either receded and decreased their volume and changed their product strategy, or push through to the high volume space and drop their prices. It's an interesting one.
It is. So look, you just consider yourself the Rolls Royce of electric motorcycles in Australia. Easy one. Because they had low volume and quality product. So there you go.
Correct. Yeah.
When we're talking about batteries for a motorcycle, an electric motorcycle, How are they different to the batteries that are used in electric cars? I mean, you talked a bit before about how we're going to solid state, but let's talk about what's actually happening now.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we use an NMC chemistry. So that's lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt. And that, I don't know if Tesla is still using them, but they definitely were for a period of time, and they might still be. And the reason to use NMC is that they are very, very power dense. So for the same amount of weight, you can push more current safely. And so, you know, we've opted to use those. Now most car manufacturers that are, you know, operating in the mass car market, you know, not necessarily performance vehicle market, they're using LFP, which is lithium iron phosphate. Again, they are considered to be slightly safer, but they are also a lot less power dense. And so they are, if you want to produce the same amount of power, you need a much bigger battery pack, or you're going to sacrifice the power. So I think that's the biggest difference between what we're doing and what the mass car market usually has. So, yeah, I think chemistry is the main one, and then the other thing when it comes to cells is form factor. And there's different types of cells out there. You've got cylindrical cells, which are, you know, kind of like your AA batteries on steroids. You then have what's called pouch cells, and they basically put the anode and the cathode and the electrolyte into a plastic sack, if you will, and that's called a pouch cell. And then the final type is a prismatic cell, where you'll basically have cylindrical type arrangements or pouch type arrangements put in a steel casing, and then connected to an exterior container. So that's called a prismatic cell, and it kind of looks like a small brick, depending on the size of the cell you're using. And so, yeah, they're the three main types of cells, and different manufacturers opt for different styles. And what drives those decisions is a number of things, whether it be the supply chain they have access to at that point in time, or certain cost factors or performance targets of their vehicles, certain serviceability characteristics or maintenance forecasts of those technologies. So battery engineering is definitely not to be taken lightly. It's a bit of an art form.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it.
And what about
too much into technical detail?
just briefly mention something about recycling once the batteries have come to the end of their life.
There's actually a big influx of new businesses, and when I say new businesses, it could be a large organisation delving into this market now, because you know, disposing of these cells once they're done and dusted is going over the next, you know, decade or two, and so they will specialise in recycling these. And in fact, I know of a Perth-based company. The name escapes me. Forgive me, Luan. I know the CEO, and they've developed new chemistry compounds that are actually able to break down certain elements and they can do various things with them. So, you know, there are things out there at the moment, but the technology is evolving rapidly, and so recycling will be, I think, certainly part of the future.
Certainly sounds
very, very important if you're looking at being energy clean at one end. It's also got to be energy clean at the other end.
Correct. Sustainability is a big
factor, for sure. Yeah. Okay, Dennis, look, just so that people would like, if they'd like to look up and see what you're doing, where can they contact you, as in that your website?
Yeah, sure. So our website's www.savicemotorcycles.com. That's SAVIC motorcycles.com. And we have a standard email, info@savicemotorcycles.com, if anyone's got any questions. And
And if anybody can't remember that, just Google electric motorcycle developer, and that's the first thing that comes up. It's fantastic.
Electric Motorcycle Australia.
Yeah, Australia developer.
Yes. Yeah.
It's and look, that's just fantastic information that you've given out tonight. Really is.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me, guys. I've actually really enjoyed it, and it's been interesting.
Well, I think the thing that we try to do is to get information out to our listeners, and you've certainly done that for us tonight. Judging by the text that I've had, it's been unreal.
It has, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. Oh, any time, guys.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much, Dennis. And
have a lovely evening.
We shall. Thank you.
And what have we got next week, guys?
Next week, we have... Oh, we're doing the... we've got... Lou coming in from a European Motorcycle Day, and we're hoping to get somebody in from the Australia, the All British Day, to talk to us about All British Day.
Okay, and Lloyd is next door, and he's getting ready for Riding the Coast Range.
And Lloyd's hair.
Lots of great music.
Lloyd has got bleached hair. That's white hair.
He shouldn't be out on the surfboard so much.
He's been out in the sun too much. Out in the sun and the salt. That's it. All right, we've got to go. We'll see you next week. Ride safe and have a great time.